that their aim is to keep the BJP away from Kashmir's grassroots.
Since the BJP came to power in India, it started taking decisions against minorities. The BJP has taken Kashmir's autonomy, Kashmiris' jobs, and now they are eyeing land. They don't care about the people of Kashmir. We came to cast our votes against those people who only aim to destroy Kashmir's ethnicity in the name of mainstreaming Kashmir.
More and more people in Kashmir have developed skepticism on the overall electoral process after scores of video interviews of the District Development Council or DDC candidates started circulating on social media. A number of candidates have no idea what positions they are running for in the local administration, and even worse, some have no idea what DDC means.
Kashmir, man.
In order for votes to be equally distributed, the Election Commission has accepted nominations from all sorts of people. There is no set pay requisite for candidates. I wonder who they are empowering. How can an uneducated person with no idea of economy, finance and politics seek equal rights and development for me? Basically, they do not need educated people. They want stooges who will implement what the Indian government will decide for us, without thinking about people's interests.
This is the first time that DDC elections are being held. Members of the DDC are expected to prepare and approve district plans and expenditure schemes, which will replace the district planning and development boards in all districts across the region. Earlier, district development boards looked after the planning, approval or implementation of centrally sponsored schemes. The result of the 8-phase elections will be announced on December 22nd. Apparently, the elections in Kashmir have paved the way for other electoral processes in the volatile region. However, many say this ballot has made the people of Kashmir politically aware of the fact that New Delhi is trying to thrust such electoral processes in order to create an impression that normalcy has taken hold after it stripped Kashmir of its autonomy. Actually, without building trust and bridging the gaps. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The Chinese military on Saturday said it had tailed and monitored a U.S. warship as it passed through the Taiwan Strait. The military said the move deliberately raises the temperature of the Taiwan issue. It said the move jeopardizes peace and stability in the strait. The Chinese military also accused the U.S. of using the Taiwan issue as a pawn for what it called selfish strategic purposes. The U.S. Navy, however, said its guided missile destroyer was on a routine mission in accordance with international law. China considers Taiwan as part of its own territory and is opposed to the increasing U.S. support for the island. Last week, the U.S. approved a new major arms sales to Taiwan in a deal worth $280 million. The package is the sixth this year and includes advanced military communications equipment. Washington says the sale aims to improve the security of Taiwan, but some analysts believe the U.S. seeks to push back against China.
The United States doesn't want to create a war over Taiwan, but is trying to push the envelope, is trying to, without breaking the one-China policy, is selling more and more arms to Taiwan, as I said, as part of the pushback against China.
Tensions have been simmering between the U.S. and China over other issues as well, from trade to the coronavirus pandemic and political developments in Hong Kong. The U.S. has also prepared a so-called entity list that mainly hits key Chinese industries over what Washington calls ties to China's military. On Thursday, the Pentagon said U.S. warships would be more assertive in responding to what it described as violations of international law. It accused China of being the most pressing long-term strategic threat. In response, China said it seeks no conflict with the U.S. and wants mutual respect and cooperation leading to a win-win outcome.
We hope that the U.S. side will take a rational and objective view of China's development of its national defense and armed forces, work with China to focus on cooperation, manage differences, and bring the China-U.S. relationship back to the right track.
The souring ties between China and the U.S. come in the wake of President Donald Trump's America First policy. With the incoming U.S. President Joe Biden set to take office on January 20th, it remains to be seen how the currently toxic relationship between the world's two biggest economies will look like. Will the new U.S. president stick to Trump's policy tools and continue the frictions Will he try to de-escalate the tensions, or will he take a more aggressive anti-China approach?
Russian President Vladimir Putin held his annual press conference. This year it was held in a new format, video conferencing, because of pandemic.
The end of the year Q&A session is a rare chance to get President Putin to answer important issues and draw attention to the country's problems. It has long become one of the biggest media events in the country, broadcasted live on main news channels and radio stations in Russia for the whole duration.
Speaking about the new START arms control treaty between Washington and Moscow, Putin accused the U.S. of starting a new arms race. Putin reiterated his call urging Washington to extend the new START arms control treaty for 1 year.
Now there's a threat that strategic arms reduction treaty is terminated. This would mean that there are no more restrictions on the arms race. None at all. We have called and continue to call on our Western partners to extend this treaty for at least a year. During this year, we would have substantive talks, as diplomats say, on what to do next and how to live on.
Putin said he believed U.S. President-elect Joe Biden is open to dialogue on the issue, but added Russia needs some reaction from the U.S.
That it is the last point that connects the Russian Federation with the United States on strategic issues, because all other treaties and agreements signed by Soviet Union, Russian Federation and the United States were dismissed, were destroyed by administration of Trump. Now we are entering a new period of development in American policy. That's why we hope that previous all agreements and treaties will be respected.
The new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, also known as START, is the last remaining agreement that maintains a nuclear balance between the two countries. Putin also said that the unfounded poisoning scenario of opposition politician Alexei Navalny was in fact part of the US-backed plot repeated by media to try to discredit the Russian leader. He stressed that Navalny was not important enough to be a target. Navalny, 44, was taken ill on a domestic flight on August 20. He was later transported to the German capital. German doctors, however, claimed Navalny had been poisoned with a substance from the group of cholinesterase inhibitors. Since then, Germany and other Western governments have been attacking Russia with accusations that it poisoned Navalny. Moscow has repeatedly and strongly rejected the allegation. Marina Putunova, Moscow.
Before entering his latest and perhaps last round of negotiations with UK counterparts, the EU's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, addressed the European Parliament early on Friday morning.
Nous sommes à un moment de vérité.
It is the moment of truth.
Il nous reste...
We have very little time remaining, just a few hours to work through these negotiations in a useful fashion if we want this agreement to enter into force on the 1st of January.
There are less than 2 weeks to go before Britain might crash out of the Brexit transition period without a crucial EU trade deal.
Shameful UK government strategy.
Some EU lawmakers are in no doubt as to which side is to blame for the deadlock.
The UK government is taking endless time to realise that some illusions of Brexit simply cannot be delivered.
Many legislators claim the UK faces financial ruin if Boris Johnson's government fails to reach an agreement with the EU. Meanwhile, the Scottish National Party is waiting in the wings to call a second independence referendum that could very well see the breakup of the United Kingdom. It has been pointed out that long delays can already be witnessed at EU-UK border crossings.
Dear British friends, is this what you voted for? Passport stamps and lorry queues? This moment is a victory for Europe.
But the European Union is in no position to gloat, it has been argued.
The real division isn't between the EU and the UK. It's between the haves and the have-nots, and we start dealing with that or there'll be a lot more Brexits to come.
Deal or no deal, business groups say the EU needs to pursue major structural reforms, especially in the context of Brexit.
there's a mismatch clearly. So we need better mobility. We need to be able to match the supply with the demand for workers across Europe, not just within member states.
Fishing rights remain the major sticking point in the negotiations. One EU lawmaker has reminded Boris Johnson that his closest ally will soon be history. The COVID-19 pandemic is still here, and so he should choose his next moves carefully. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. And in this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise the children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Raishahri. And we have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear sister.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for inviting me over.
Thank you so much for being here. So in our previous discussions, we have been talking about self-esteem, which is a very important and crucial topic. And unfortunately, sometimes we tend to neglect it, especially with our children who are young, because we feel at that time they don't really need that respect, or, you know, but we don't know that it is from a young age that if these things are instilled, then when they grow up, they will become much stronger and better. And so we have been talking a lot about this, and we spoke at the end about the do's and don'ts and how we want this will affect the child's, you know, upbringing and increase their self-esteem.
Yeah, some do's and don'ts practical we should apply so as to enhance the self-esteem.
Yes,
and some
exactly.
Don'ts so that the self-esteem cannot go away, it can stay, right?
Uh-huh.
So one of the that we talked about was do give the child
duties.
Responsibility. It's
okay.
Very important. And then another do is do talk to them about the major changes and decisions of the family. For example, if you're supposed to shift from one house to another, or for example, if there's a decision of some people coming to live over your home,
yeah.
You know, for some time, your relatives, so talk to him about it beforehand.
Exactly.
That, you know, he should be prepared mentally. Don't let him feel surprised.
But oh,
just, yeah, dragged along the scenes, you know. He should feel that these things are worthy to be discussed, and they have considered me as part of the family.
Yeah.
A child is smart enough to feel that, even if he can't express that.
Mm.
But he knows that he's considered important.
So unless you want to surprise them.
Yeah, unless you want to surprise them, for example, their birthday parties, which they would be very enthusiastic of. But no, here we are talking about major decisions and changes in the family. For example, if somebody else is going to collect them from school, we should, you know, tell them
in advance.
That so-and-so is going to collect you, so don't feel worried about it, that we didn't come.
Mm.
Regard him as like a proper human being, intellectual human being. And another thing is, do teach him not to accept undue praise or flattery.
Uh-huh.
It's very important. The child likes to be praised, of course, but only when he deserves it, he should accept it, and that even not get a gluttonous about it.
Yeah.
In the sense that sometimes, you know, a child might be praised, you know, like this happens to a person who's done a good thing, but grandparents keep on probably praising him. So he should be prepared that this, you know, why we quoted this as a do is because when, if he doesn't do this kind of behavior and he feels he's believing all the praises that are showered on him, it may turn to pride.
Yeah.
He may feel that there's nobody as good as me. Mm. So the parent should teach him that whenever somebody tells you something, know about yourself. You know yourself better than everybody else, and Allah knows you the best. So think about it. Did you really deserve this praise? If you didn't, maybe you can tell them what you did only.
Mm.
Or maybe if you did, thank Allah for it. Never even accept so much flattery. Anyway, flattery is not supposed to be done to a person because it's like throwing dust on the face.
Yeah.
As it spoils a person.
So we should do it in an extent where we just want to encourage them, not to like make them feel, oh, they're just too good.
Yeah, exactly. Flattery is when you spoil a person.
Mm.
You make him feel that now there's nobody like me.
Yeah.
I'm too good of myself.
So, for example, they win in a competition and then everybody's praising them. When they go back home, you should make it feel that you did a very good job and I'm proud of you. But now not go over it that, oh, really, there's nobody like you.
Yeah, exactly. If such things happen, for example, this competition scenario that you're saying, it's very interesting. Yeah, when they come home, the parents should now acknowledge that to the child. That, look, although many people praised you and everything, but if you go and look at it, like, who gave you all these qualities?
Mm.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave you, right? It can be snatched anytime. So never be proud of it. Always struggle for it and never even feel that you're the best. They could be out there better than you, right? So
after, like, positive that you did good, then you slowly give them a hint that, yeah, but you know, this is very true.
In future, then they would know that they would not accept praise and flattery very easily.
Just like that, yeah. Very true. Thank you very much. And we're just going to take a short break and we'll continue this discussion after that.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to your audience to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. So we've been talking about self-esteem and the do's that should be done in order to, you know, increase the self-esteem of a child. And we've been discussing about that we are supposed to do, give our children duties, tell them about the changes that are supposed to occur in the family, make them feel important, and not to accept undue praise.
Yeah. Now we come to the don'ts.
Okay.
So don't interfere in everything your child does.
Mm-hmm.
The child needs some space of healthy independence and his own originality.
Mm.
If he wishes to arrange his things in a particular way, for example, or plan something for himself, let him do it, as long as it is not wrong in a serious way.
Yeah.
So some parents expect children to do everything exactly as they wish and fuss over every small detail in the child's life. Now such a child grows up to feel that he cannot make decisions anymore himself.
Exactly.
So give some space to a child. It's very important that when he does something, you know, let him arrange him in his room in his own way. Let him decide how to go about his timetable in his own way, as long as he is going according to his timetable.
Yeah.
Let him
decide what to wear.
Exactly. Yeah, things like that. So don't interfere with everything. Maybe you can tell your opinion if you would have worn, for example, this.
Yeah.
It would be better, but now you made your own decision. He should know where he went wrong also. So he'll come to know it. You know, along the lines, he'll come to know that, yeah, this was not a very good decision. But at least that he'll be able to make his own decisions, which is the important thing for self-esteem.
Exactly.
Another thing we should not be doing, don't pamper the child too much when he's sick or hurt especially.
Mm.
This is very important because, you know, our heart comes out for the child, that when he feels pain. You know, he shouldn't pamper him so much as it's more than what he, you know, like he deserves or he needs. Because, you know, the child would be, would learn how to become strong and live with pain. He should be told, of course, that I'm so sorry, I know how you feel, but Allah is the healer, you'll come out of it. You're strong enough to come out. Also, you know, making him feel that now he can't do anything, he just has to rest if he has, for example, he's sick or something. Make him do things that he could do within his, you know, capabilities at that time, so that he can learn how to tackle with them in future and be strong. This gives him a sense of self-esteem that no matter what, you know, I can do things even in the hardest times of pain or things like that.
This tends to occur a lot because our children.
Or when a person is bedridden.
Yeah.
Don't make him feel that you're just bedridden. No.
You can't do anything.
Be strong and come to the bathroom, for example.
Mm.
Be strong and come to the dining table.
Yeah, exactly.
Join in the conversation. Make him feel that he's into it and he can do things. And struggle with his pain also and hardships. So he'll become a very strong person in future.
Definitely. Thank you very much. So we're just going to take a short break and we'll continue this discussion. Please stay tuned.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said, Honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back to your audience to IRIB English Radio broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. So we've been talking about the do's and don'ts, the do's on what we should do so as to increase the child's self-esteem, and the don'ts, what not to do to spoil that, you know, growth of self-esteem. So we spoke about some of the don'ts, that we don't have to interfere in the child's originality, and we don't have to pamper the child too much when he is sick. So you are going to tell us, I think, one more don't.
Yeah, don't ignore the child when you have come.
Uh-huh.
When parents have company, for example, when a family has guests, Islamic akhlaq and etiquette demands that the host pay great respect to the guests, of course.
Yeah.
But this does not mean that the children should be ignored and brushed aside.
Yeah.
Instead, the parents should encourage the child to be part of the gathering and involve him with the guests.
Introduce him to the guests.
Exactly.
Make him feel, you know.
And also prepare the child beforehand that guests are coming. So be involved. Say salam to them. You know, when they ask you something, reply to them.
Yeah.
Be good to them. Come serve to them. Things like that. So it's not as if, you know, when you're talking even with your best friend, you brush the child off. This will make him feel that they are more important than me. Although it's not the case.
Yeah.
It can never be the case. The child is the most important.
We forget.
We forget, and these small things, you know, build up like building blocks and make him, the child, feel lack of self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
That if, for example, certain guests come or my mother's best friend comes, I'm neglected.
Yeah.
So he'll always feel that he's second-hand. You know, he comes second. It is the life of his parents.
Exactly.
If they are friends around or guests around, the child should always be involved, that he is an important part of the family.
Mm.
There's a hadith from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam who has mentioned that Allah has decreed everything for a believer except when he humiliates himself.
Mm.
Yeah, that's when he lacks that self-esteem. He humiliates himself. You know, lack of self-esteem will make a person, for example, not trust himself, not do important things, lag behind, moving towards, you know, the path of Allah, sin,
yeah.
And for example, not trust that he has certain abilities, and also sometimes expect from people,
yeah.
And get, you know, dejected in the process of expecting from people, because there's a hadith that says that whoever expects from the people is obviously put off. Put down, because it's only Allah that one person has to expect.
Yeah, it's like a feeling like you're stooping low, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Stooping low is the outcome of this lack of self-esteem that makes you expect
from others.
Now, advantages of healthy self-esteem.
Okay.
It's not the pride and vanity again, it's just the healthy self-esteem. One of the advantages is the child who knows that he has some good qualities and that others respect him is satisfied with himself. So he wouldn't be looking out for attention elsewhere. You know, when a child is grown up, now he has developed himself mentally. So now he knows that he has some, you know, like good qualities, and he is satisfied with himself. So he wouldn't look outwards to for respect and, you know, wrong kind of, the same kind of expectations we were talking about. He would expect others to respect him.
Yeah.
He would get it, but he would expect. So this will translate into rational and calm behavior.
Yeah.
He would have a calm behavior, and there'll be no need for aggressiveness or to demand attention. And he'll be a happy child. If he's given that respect at home and taught all these things, he'll be a calm and happy child.
Inshallah, thank you very much. That's all the time that we have, unfortunately. Dear audience, thank you for joining us on this program. And if you have any questions, comments or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Until the next program, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The debate.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kavita Wei. It is called the biggest hack of the U.S. government in years. And the U.S., without proof, initially said that Russia is responsible, but now it has said China is also in on it. Well, the hacks were on such organizations like the Treasury and Commerce Departments, and even nuclear agencies within the U.S. In this edition of the debate, we will look at whether the U.S. is weak and vulnerable against these types of hacks, or have the hackers actually advanced so much that it could risk world security. Let's find out first more about these hacks. Wyatt Reed is our correspondent who joins us from Washington, D.C. Wyatt, please tell us about the hacks in terms of which agencies have been affected, because, for example, you had the U.S. Treasury that came out and said, as far as we can tell, nothing severe has been actually incurred on their, I guess, operations. At the same time, one of the organizations, or should I say entities, that is not really highlighted that much is nuclear organizations within the U.S., if there's truth to that, to have been affected.
Well, you're right in that we really just simply do not know exactly who is affected. Really, we don't know the basic five W's that any sort of journalistic endeavor is supposed to encompass: the who, the what, the why, the where, the when. None of this information has really been published by any of the reports that have come out so far. Much of it is largely speculative, almost entirely sourced to quote-unquote unnamed intelligence officials, people familiar with the matter. This sort of language is the type that's being employed to source this story. So we simply do not know in great part, really, who exactly has been affected, nor do we know for sure who was behind it. All of the sources, again, on this are people coming from the Department of the Defense, from the CIA, from the NSA, organizations who would have an incentive. And indeed, we know that the CIA actually does possess the capability of spoofing its own attacks to make them seem as though they're coming from other countries, other organizations. It's likely they're not the only only organization with access to this kind of technology. So really, the most basic variables of this story are simply not known. And, you know, I think that that will likely be the case going forward, but I would be happy to be proven wrong.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Wyatt Reed, our correspondent there. talking to us from Washington, D.C. Mike Billington is from the Executive Intelligence Review, who joins us from Hamilton, Virginia. Maybe he can shed some light on this and give us his analysis. Mike Billington, welcome. So our correspondent there has said that it's not quite clear yet the depth of the hack. Perhaps you can tell us about that and how this actually may have happened, because we're also looking at a duration of time from 10 months ago based on some reports that the hack began, and we're just hearing about it now.
I can't tell you the depth of it. I think your previous fellow is right, that they really don't know the extent of this. But I think what's clear, what is known, is that we're seeing another case of what Donald Trump correctly says is Russia, 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 fake news. There's no evidence, none whatsoever has been presented, just as there has been no evidence presented over these last 4 years of the claims by the Obama and Bush intelligence circles and their British friends about the collusion between Russia and Trump, or Russia at all, not even with Trump, in the 2016 election. There's no evidence, there's no proof. The Russians have very clearly ridiculed it as typical jokes. And you may or may not know Bill Binney, who is a very close friend of our LaRouche organization and appears with us regularly on our programs, who was the head of the technical division at the NSA, who actually developed the Thin Thread program, which was designed to root out terrorist acts, but was then misused by the NSA to set up the most massive mass surveillance in the history of the human race. Still the case that the U.S., while it's screaming and yelling about China having a surveillance economy, has the most massive surveillance capacities in history. And as your previous spokesman said, the what was called the marble framework part of the system that was set up and which Snowden revealed has the capacity to put fake source material in a leak in order to make it appear to come from Russia or Iran or China or anybody else. So this is known. I would say that probably the best proof that this is not Russia, remember who Adam Schiff is, he's the member of the U.S. Intelligence Committee in the House, who for the last 4 years has said, I have absolute proof that Russia interfered in the 2016 election and fixed it for Donald Trump. And of course, he had no such evidence, any more than the U.S. had evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq when we decided to criminally and illegally destroy that country. This has now become common from this intelligence community. Trump actually took some major steps to try to rein this in, but he's only been partially successful. And we're now dealing with another Russia, Russia, Russia hoax, whose purpose is to set the stage for the Biden administration, if he gets in, which he may not, but he may, to be prepared for what they, in fact, were moving on during the Obama-Biden time, which was to prepare for war against Russia and China.
Okay. Let me bring in our guest, Vladimir Sutnikov, from Moscow. He's a strategic analyst from the Russian Academy of Sciences. Vladimir Sutnikov, welcome. So let me get first your reaction of how the U.S. Secretary of State was pretty sure, as he said, that Russia was behind it. Donald Trump said no in so many words and pointed the finger of blame at China. And our guest there has said that there is no proof that Russia was behind this. So first, your reaction to this.
My reaction, actually, this is a very good question. My reaction is it's absolutely rubbish. You know, Russia has nothing to do, and Russia just formally rejected these allegations and accusations of interfering by hackers hacking the U.S. governmental, some U.S. governmental institutions and agencies. And this is absolutely rubbish, because nor Russia, neither China nor Russia has nothing to do with this. What actually could be possible that once some a certain non-state actor And if you remember the ISIS activities back, two, three years ago, there were a lot of young, sophisticated, bright computer specialists, computer engineers from Western Europe, who came for big money to ISIS stronghold in Syria to work for ISIS, being paid huge money. And I'm not claiming that this is ISIS, but any possible non-state actor, any possible radical Islamist organization could be standing behind this and could making the hacking attack by these computer scientists who actually probably stayed with them and tried to penetrate the U.S. governmental agencies, CIA, FBI, some NGOs in the United States, something tanks. So this is probably like this. This is my first feeling, which actually I felt when I heard this news for the first time. And I think that the United States simply doesn't have any strong proof of any interference, neither Trump about China, nor Biden president-elect team, nor even Pompeo, State Secretary Pompeo, who actually claimed that Russia is accused by the United States of cyber attacks against U.S. Agencies.
Okay.
So that is my feeling.
Well, Mike Billington, to go along with what you have said, first of all, before we continue here, let me make sure that we, at least I know from you, Mike Billington, what your views are. I mean, do you believe that the U.S. was hacked, the different agencies that were involved?
Question. I think Mr. Sotokoff could very well be right that this is a non-state actor. We don't know because, of course, there's nothing being revealed about this. In fact, the person who was in charge for Homeland Security of our cybersecurity, this guy Chris Krebs, who lied and said there was the current election, the presidential election, was clean, there was no fraud, obvious lie, and Trump fired him. He's now running around ranting that this is Russia. And if in fact it were, then he certainly didn't do his job. But I think the other thing, the other possibility at least, that Mr. Sobukoff would probably agree, is what your question implied, which is that this might not even be a serious breach. This might be an artificial breach run by the CIA. They have the capacity, as Mr. Binney exposed in his multiple studies of this, showing, for instance, that there was no hacking of the DNC computers, which was the basis of the entire Russiagate hoax, that in fact it was a download, that it's very possible that this is itself a hoax, a fraud, that the massive hacking may not even be true. In order to create a new Russiagate hoax to go along with the Chinagate hoax that's been perpetrated by Pompeo and the other radical lunatics in the Trump administration. But this is very possibly meant to set up a next administration, if they succeed in getting Biden in, which they may or may not. There's still a very, very serious potential for overthrowing this fake election, the massive vote fraud that's already been exposed and never listened to in court. No court has heard the evidence. Every court has ruled that they don't have standing to protest this, which is why Trump himself brought the case to the Supreme Court yesterday. So this is all in the works, trying to prepare for Biden, who's already announced that he's hired plans to hire a Secretary of State whose only complaint about the Obama-Biden administration was that they didn't fully invade and destroy Syria the way they did Libya. And you can expect that will happen if you get the war party back in power. That the reason they had to get Trump out was because he's insisted on pulling out of these regime change wars, and they want to restore, in the midst of this massive global financial breakdown crisis taking place, only partially because of the pandemic.
Right.
It was already in the works. But in the midst of this, they cannot allow Trump to work with Putin, as he's insisted he should, and to end these endless wars. So okay. They therefore put absolutely everything they had into trying to bring down Donald Trump personally.
Vladimir Sotnikov, the timing of this is something also that is somewhat interesting. And in terms of what the U.S. administration, if, as our guest said, the President-elect Biden gets elected to come into the White House, the chief of staff of the incoming White House chief of staff has said that President-elect Joe Biden's response to this will go beyond sanctions against Russia. So if that is the case, what type of reactions may we see if and when Joe Biden comes into the White House against Russia?
Yeah. Well, actually, thinking about that in the retrospective, actually, that you remember that President-elect Joseph Biden actually promised in his election campaign that he will significantly try to get the relations between the U.S. and Russia better. So you are right. The timing is very interesting because in a month or so, there will be a solemn oath of President-elect Biden on the 20th of January, and the new administration came to life. So I think my analysis is that Biden is not going to significantly get the relations between the United States better, because for two simple reasons. First of all, some circles in the United States, right, influential circles, right, like the military-industrial complex, some hoaxes in the U.S. Senate, in the Congress, and some influential businessmen won't let Biden, who probably actually won the elections on their money and on their support, to move ahead with the improving the U.S.-Russia relations. And the second reason, a simple reason too, is that we actually evidencing right now, we are witnessing the new Cold War. And I agree with my American colleague that this Russiagate hoax, Chinagate hoax, or whoever gate hoax, they won't let the new administration to improve the relations with Russia. So that means that the election promises of Joseph Biden wouldn't be coming true.
Okay,
Mike. Unfortunately, this is my analysis. This is my forecast.
So, Mike Billington, let's go along with that line. What can we expect from Joe Biden, again, if he is successful in coming into the White House? What type of approach may he want to pursue with Russia, and what will happen if the aggressive stance against Russia, as it sounds like from Joe Biden's response so far to this hacking campaign, is that a window of how he will be treating Russia in the future?
You have to look at this from above, not from below. If you have a Biden administration, we're facing a global holocaust, and I mean a holocaust. The World Food Program has already warned that we could have 270 million deaths in Africa from starvation, not just from the COVID, but from starvation. We will watch the Biden team not only rejoin the Paris climate change hoax, but implement what they call green finance, the intentional cutting off of credit, and this is what's been organized by the Bank of England chief and his cohorts, a cutting off of credit that to all, not only fossil fuels, but to any industry that has a so-called carbon footprint based on the lie that carbon has something to do with climate change. We're looking at a global holocaust that will make anything in history pale by significance. And the war danger is simply aggravated by this global pandemic, financial breakdown crisis, threatening war danger, and so forth. So you have to do everything in your power to help expose the stealing of this election by the war party that supported Biden and by the British, who, as I'm sure you know, the House of Lords wrote years ago that everything possible must be done to prevent Trump from having a second term and doing what he threatens to do, which is to be friends with Russia, which he said was a good thing. And same similarly with China, where he was working with Xi Jinping until he fell for this foolish idea that he should blame them for the pandemic. But other than that, we had the potential of breaking up this British division of the world between the East and the West and bringing the U.S. and Russia and China together in a way that could end terrorism. It could reestablish the Bretton Woods financial system.
Okay.
These are still possible, but it must be done soon. And by the way, I think the potential of Trump pardoning Assange and Snowden and bringing that truth forth to the American people and to the world is the best chance we have of breaking up the vote fraud and actually turning the situation around in the U.S., which is extremely dangerous without doing something like that kind of a flanking operation.
Well, we'll find that out in due time. Okay. It seems like that's the end of the debate. Let me thank our guests. We have Vladimir Slutnikov, who's a strategic analyst from the Russian Academy of Sciences.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. And from the Executive Intelligence Review, Mike Billington, thank you for your comments. And that does it for this edition of the debate. For Mika Vatave, entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, frauds and cheaters. Those who find their happiness in misfortunes of others and their profit in loss of others are neither humans nor true Muslims. They lack that social character which gives man superiority over other creatures. Losses can be inflicted openly or may be hidden through frauds and tricks and other forms of dishonesty. Islam forbids these. Remember, brothers and sisters, Islam is a lifestyle. It forbids these types of tricks and tactics, whatever the form may be, as is apparent from the disgust expressed in the saying of Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam. The Imam says, one who defrauds or causes a loss to a Muslim or tricks him does not belong to us. Over here, and many other traditions which talk about, you know, they don't belong to us, over here it means that they are not from among the Muslims. They are not the part of the Muslim Ummah. So brothers and sisters, fraud and cheating and, playing all these tricks and tactics to deceive others, this is something that is condemned in Islam. Islam does not appreciate that sort of attitude and that sort of approach. Unfortunately, the world we live in, we see that those who do fraud and those who cheat others, they get to climb up the ladder in many cases. But rest assured, Islam is not endorsing any of those tactics and any of those strategies that are based on deception, lies, fraud, and cheat. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the frauds and the cheaters. We don't like them. We all unanimously say we don't like to be cheated upon. Now, cheating and deception are despicable characteristics that are beneath a decent person. Intentionally distorting the truth in order to mislead others contradicts the values of honesty, which requires an attitude of sincerity, straightforwardness, and fairness that leaves no room for cheating. There's no room for lying. There's no room for trickery or deceit. There are many texts from the Quran and the Sunnah of the Holy Prophet and infallible Imams conveying the meaning that cheating, whether the target be Muslims or non-Muslims, is forbidden. Accepting the guidance of Islam leads a person to truthfulness, which means a person completely avoids cheating and backstabbing. A lot of times, especially when it comes to the Muslim youth, they tend to think that it's okay to deceive the non-Muslims just because they're not Muslims. When it comes to Muslims, they understand these concepts, but when it comes to non-Muslims, for some reason, they come to a conclusion that it's okay to deceive them. It's okay to trick them. Guess what, brothers and sisters? Islam does not allow you to be unfair with a non-Muslim either. Islam wants you to be careful in your attitude, whether it is towards a Muslim or it is towards a non-Muslim. Now, of course, there's a small little point that you need to keep in mind, and that is the non-Muslims who are at war with Islam and Muslims. Those are known as kuffar, kuffar-e-harbi, and those non-Muslims who are at war with Islam and Muslims, that is an exception to the case. Other than that, all non-Muslims are supposed to be treated with fairness. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time.